and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from our studio in London. Europe has endured nearly 1,000 days of war since Russia's large-scale invasion of Ukraine, and now a glimmer of light for Kyiv. After months of pressure from Volodymyr Zelensky's government, the US has given Ukraine a possible lifeline. Ukraine can now use some of America's most sophisticated long-range missiles on targets that lie deep inside Russian territory. Moscow said before that the use of the US-made ATACMS missiles on its territory would cross a red line. In the last few minutes, Ukraine's foreign minister has said the missiles would be a game-changer. President Biden hasn't made a formal announcement about the ATACMS missiles, but speaking at the G20 summit in Brazil, he urged other nations to support Ukraine.
We all have to work to end the conflicts and crises that are eroding progress in food security around the world. Ukraine, the United States strongly supports Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Everyone around this table, in my view, should as well.
Over this edition of NewsHour, we'll hear responses to the missile news from Russia and Germany and those covering developments on the front lines of the conflict. But first, today, the governor of Ukraine's Black Sea port city of Odessa says a Russian missile attack has killed at least 10 people. The Ukrainian member of parliament, Oleksiy Goncharenko, was nearby when the missile hit.
It was awful. I live just 200 meters from there. So I heard the explosion, I ran there, and I saw horrific picture of people in blood, screaming, awful. And that is absolutely civilian area, middle of the day of Monday. People were coming to cafes, there is a flower market there, just usual life, medical center, and people just were killed by a Russian missile coming. Fortunately, this is our reality. And this is a terror which Russia makes against civilian people.
And so how do you and the people around you in Odessa feel about the U.S. decision to allow Ukraine to use long-range missiles supplied by the U.S. to strike into Russia?
I should be frank with you. We definitely welcome this decision. But at the same time, we are so frustrated that it took 1,000 days and thousands of Ukrainians' lives to finally make this decision. And we don't know for how long will it last, because Biden administration is leaving, and we don't know what is the position on this of future Trump administration. Also, to make this decision really making some difference, and serious difference, it should be accompanied with a big number of missiles, because if we will have 35, 45 missiles or something like this, that will not make a big difference. So we need a lot of missiles together with this permission in order to make a difference on the front line and also to protect civilian lives inside the country.
We've heard some objections, though, most recently from Slovakia's Prime Minister, Robert Fico, who's strongly objected to the U.S. decision. He's called it an unprecedented escalation of tensions, and he said it would thwart hopes for the start of any peace talks. Are you concerned about this?
First of all, Mr. Fico is quite silent when it was not clear who will be the next U.S. president, and now he is so brave to criticize Biden. Mr. Fico, unfortunately, is playing Russian games. That is a very unfortunate, but it's fact. I don't know what escalation we're talking about. Russia is using everything to kill us, our allies, and I just want to remind you that United States and United Kingdom were two countries which pressed Ukraine 30 years ago to give up our nukes to Russia. And we did it for the first time in human history. And instead of this, we received some paper which was called Security Guarantees, Budapest Memorandum. But it happens that, sorry, we can take this paper only to toilet. So I think that if the world wants to have international order, the United States and United Kingdom especially wants to show that they respect the agreements and the deals which were made, we should be helped in all possible way.
The Ukrainian member of parliament, Oleksiy Goncharenko, speaking to me from Odessa. Now let's get some reaction from Russia. My NewsHour colleague Tim Frank spoke to Maria Butina. She's currently an MP with the governing United Russia Party. She used to be based in the US, where she served a short prison sentence after being convicted of trying to infiltrate US political groups. What did she make of the US decision?
I don't think that the world today needs another escalation or another step to the potentially starting the Third World War. And while the United States is playing their little games in politics, they actually push the world to a very dangerous red line. And now I see just one guy going crazy and his people going crazy just because they lost the elections. So that's nothing to do with Russia, actually. This is the revenge to Trump, and this is an attempt to escalate as much as possible so Trump is not able to give the promise to stop the war. But that's stupid.
Well, if you say that it takes the world closer to World War III, what, in that case, do you think the Russian response will be or should be?
Well, Russians don't speculate. Russians do respond, which means that our president has been telling that if you guys cross certain red lines, we're going to defend ourselves.
But so Maria, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, there have been promises that red lines are about to be crossed been crossed many, many times. I mean, it happened with the deployment of tanks. It happened with the deployment of other types of weaponry. And I mean, to be blunt, World War III has not yet happened.
Okay, well, in your words, I can hear that you probably wish it to happen. I hope it's not so, and I'm mistaken here. But anyway, this is indeed the issue between Russia and Ukraine. And the U.S. shall not teach and preach what should Ukraine think or Russia should think. This is just not their business. They're on the other continent, and I view our country deeply touched and in a close, possibly, hopefully, someday in union with Europe, because this is our land. That's not their land. And now we're letting them guys in their dirty shoes to step into our land to steal our people, our manufacturing, our philosophy, our people, and everything we have.
Maria, with the greatest respect, it's not your land, though. I mean, it's an internationally recognized border, and Paragraph 4, Article 2 of the founding Charter of the United Nations says all members shall refrain from the use of force against the territorial integrity of any state. I mean, you can say you have reason, but by whatever measure, that is something that Russia did.
How about Israel and Palestine then?
Well, I'm not
How
talking
about
Israel and Palestine. I'm talking about Russia and Ukraine.
Well, I am talking about the whole world that is now, because of the United States, lost the ability to negotiate because nobody now follows international agreements. This is what I don't like specifically, because I remember the Nation League that was simply lost because the countries couldn't sit and talk. And what I see now, we are going the same direction. And the last time, we didn't end well. And I'm very much hopeful that this time we can stop, think, for in the sake of the future of our children and the human being, just to stop the conflicts wherever they are.
The Russian MP, Maria Butina. So what difference could ATACMS missiles make to the Ukrainian war effort? Mark McKinnon is the senior international correspondent for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail, and he's been on Ukraine's front line.
I was out last week with a Ukrainian special forces team, and they were launching an attack on a target 600 kilometers away in the western Tver region of Russia. And this attack that I was watching was being carried out with long-range Ukrainian-designed drones, and it was moderately successful. Of the 35 drones they launched, they got six through. And while we were sort of going to and from the launching point, I was asking the fighters I was with, you know, like, what difference would it have made had you been able to use Western-made equipment. And the answer was payload. These Ukrainian drones had about 15 kilograms worth of explosive on each one that they launched, whereas an ATACMS or the missiles launched by an ATACMS system would have 10, 20, 40 times the explosive delivery had they been able to use those. So, of course, the target, which they were partially damaged, was a warehouse storing missiles in Russia that could be launched back at Ukraine. They could have done serious damage to that target instead of whatever moderate damage they were able to do. So on the military side of things, in terms of protecting Ukrainian cities from being hit, it will have an impact. Now, can it change the course of the war? Probably not at this point. And it's very late in the game. The Ukrainians really wanted to get this permission to use these long-range weapons before, for instance, the North Korean soldiers arrived at the front line. They wanted to hit them before they got to where they are now in the Kursk region. So this, a lot of potentially game-changing moments have passed, but still, this will be very welcomed by the Ukrainian military.
Are there any powerful weapons that have not yet been handed over to Ukraine that could, in theory, turn things around?
You know, there are, of course, weapons of mass destruction or something like that that could change the course of the war. But the Ukrainians have had these ATACMS for a while now. They've used them to hit Russian-occupied Ukrainian territory. They used them to hit Crimea. They've reduced the amount of helicopters that the Russians have, the number of missiles Russians have. They've driven back the launch sites. Russian bombers now are based further away from Ukraine, giving Ukrainian air defenses, Ukrainian cities more time to prepare before these big attacks like we saw last night. But in terms of changing the direction of the war, it's very, very difficult to see that right now. I mean, I was, before this mission I mentioned, I was on the front line down on the Pokrovsk front, which is sort of the key city that's being fought over right now. And there's just a sense when you talk to the soldiers guarding the front line, the Ukrainian troops, that they're outnumbered, they're outgunned, and it's very, very difficult to see how they can change that in the short term, especially with, you know, North Korea giving more troops to the sides that already had a massive numerical advantage.
It's been almost 1,000 days since Russia invaded Ukraine. Since that time, you've visited the country dozens of times, speaking to people from all walks of life. What's your general sense in terms of how things are going now? You said you'd spoken to soldiers and the morale on the front line. Is that markedly different than what you've been seeing on past trips?
Definitely each trip, especially the last year, the morale on the front line, the sense that this war is winnable has gone down. That is at odds so far still with Ukrainian public opinion, where, you know, in part because of the messaging that the Zelensky government has done internally, there's still this growing fatigue with the war. People want it to end, but they're not willing, according to polls, to make the sort of territorial concessions that the messages from Donald Trump's team have been that they're going to force end the war in Ukraine. And the kind of plans they've been talking about involve allowing Russia to keep the territory it holds now and exchange and give Russia guarantees that Ukraine won't join NATO, all of which would look like a big defeat to Ukraine, to the Ukrainians. And the polls simply aren't suggesting that most Ukrainians are willing to do that. So that's going to put Volodymyr Zelensky's government in a very difficult position in the months ahead if he understands the military reality and he's getting the message from the Trump administration that we're no longer going to help you, but his people at home aren't prepared for the kind of peace that might be forced on them. And that might put him in a very, make him very unpopular very quickly.
Mark MacKinnon is the senior international correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail, speaking to us after recently visiting the front line in Ukraine. Coming up, one of the many stories of those people who have risked their lives to cross the border between Turkey and its European Union neighbors.
After I leave the town in Turkey and walking for almost half a day, I reached to the river. And this river was very wide and I have to swim on it. I was preparing myself, so I had big plastic bags to put my stuff on it. And I was swimming like more than a minute to cross this river.
A reminder of some of the other stories we're covering this hour. A UN resolution calling for an immediate end to Sudan's civil war has been vetoed by Russia. President Lula of Brazil has told world leaders gathered in Rio de Janeiro it's up to them to end global hunger. And Hamas claims to have killed gang members who looted aid trucks in Gaza after a major attack on a UN convoy over the weekend. You're listening to NewsHour. Let's focus on South Africa now. 2 weeks have passed since police in the small northwestern town of Stilfontein blocked off all exits to an abandoned coal mine. They vowed to arrest the hundreds, possibly thousands, of miners who were deep underground inside the mine. Those miners, called Zama Zamas, take extraordinary risks to enter the dangerous mine shafts in order to scavenge what's left below. Some of the trapped miners have surfaced and have been arrested by police, but many remain below ground and supplies of food and water are dwindling. The Pretoria High Court ruled on Saturday that miners should be allowed to leave and exits to the mine shouldn't be blocked. But today, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa said it was right for police to block escape routes so no one can avoid arrest. Filia Nwaje is head of the paralegal unit at the social organization Makua, Mining Affected Communities United in Action. She gave me the latest updates.
There are a lot of people who are dehydrated at the moment, people who are out of their chronic medications, people who are struggling with the fact that they don't have access to enough food. It's actually quite a dire situation at the moment. Rescue services need 3 to 4 days to set up the rigging to extract people from underground. So there's just not enough urgency to get people out from the shaft.
There are also some reports that some below ground are too weak to be able to exit the mine themselves. If someone wanted to leave, could they?
Police have trapped them underground, whereby they've blockaded the entrances, leaving one exit which would leave them trespassing if they were to exit that way. And in fact, because they have not been getting enough food and water, they are too weak to actually get themselves out of the deep, deep, deep tunnels down there.
We're hearing some mixed messages from the authorities. The High Court has ruled that the miners should be allowed to leave, and the president has said that the miners should be arrested once they come above ground. Has this gap between the court and the president affected what's actually happening on the ground?
In fact, it has. This is a crime of poverty. We cannot be criminalizing people who are poor. The people who are artisanal miners are just trying to make a living for themselves. And these minerals make their way into the formal market in any case. The Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources has not done their job correctly in terms of making sure that legal mining companies have rehabilitated mining shafts correctly.
Filia, there are reports that criminal gangs are looming in the background of all of this, that they control access to the mines, they profit from what the miners retrieve from down below. Are there any attempts by police to target those groups too?
This is something that I can't completely comment on, but this is what happens when there's a gap in the legislation that allows for artisanal miners to not be regulated. And this is what Makua has been trying to fight for, along with the National Association for Artisanal Miners. We have been saying that the Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources should include artisanal miners in the framework of the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act, so that this area can be legislated. Should it not be legislated, it allows for a criminal element to creep in.
Do you have any clear estimate of how many miners are still underground?
It's not clear at this stage, but it can certainly be said that it's more than 1,000 miners. It's very difficult to say how many people are stuck there, especially because many of them are so weak and frail at this stage in the game.
Filia Nwaje from the South African group Mining Affected Communities in Action. To Pakistan now, where over the last 2 weeks, the country's second biggest city, Lahore, has been cloaked under unprecedented levels of air pollution. The clouds have been so thick, they have been visible from space. Schools, universities and parks have been closed, construction stopped and a lockdown planned in an attempt to try to limit the health impacts from the smog. Our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davies went to Lahore to see what life's like in the city now.
Lahore was known as the City of Gardens. Now the soundtrack to its streets is traffic noise, not birdsong. In the last 2 weeks, air quality has hit unprecedented toxic levels here. Some, like rickshaw driver Asif Ali, say they cannot escape it.
We are compelled to go out because we have children. If we stay home, what will we do? We have to earn our livelihood. There is no other option. Not everyone is a job holder. We are laborers. We need to earn to be able to eat.
In the University of Lahore's teaching hospital, Dr. Irfan Malik estimates he's seen up to a 25% increase in patients on his ward.
These all patients mostly present with increase in cough and worsening shortness of breath, and they are having classical asthmatic symptoms. And remember one thing, we are all not asthmatic, but this is weather which is aggravating them.
He's worried that winter is almost here.
In coming 1 or 2 weeks, there will be a cold wave that will hit this Lahore and major cities of Pakistan. So cold waves along with the smoke is a lethal weapon. And I am expecting there will be significant surge in the respiratory diseases.
Lahore's markets are far from empty, but some have no choice but to stay inside. Iram Adnan has three children, two with special needs.
Cough is not going. Everyone has in our home is having cough, and these two kids are more affected with smoke as compared to the other people in the home. The kids with special needs have low immunity.
Very good. 3-1. Finish. Smile. 3-1.
Schools are closed. So are the parks. Iram keeps the children occupied with indoor board games. But it's difficult.
They are greatly disturbed by all this haphazardness because they don't have anything to do. It is very difficult to survive in this environment. And we are thinking that it's high time to shift somewhere because every day we are affected by it.
Pakistan sees smog most years. The provincial government insists it was trying to control it, but hadn't prepared for this level, says Raja Jahangir Anwar, the environment minister in the Punjab government.
Air quality index is beyond our control. And I must admit that it is actually a surprise for us. We were not ready to, face such kind of surge in AQI. The whole of the government is actually working towards mitigation of smog. We know that this is a long battle.
Pakistan's pollution problem has not come out of thin air. It's built up over years. Change will take money and political will. If they fail, millions may stay trapped in these toxic clouds.
Our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davies reporting from smoggy Lahore. Stay with us. Lots more to come on NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. The UN Relief Agency for Palestinian Refugees says one of its aid convoys has been raided by armed looters in Gaza. The organization says at least 97 of its trucks carrying vital supplies are missing. More than 2 million people in the territory are currently dependent on humanitarian aid for their survival. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner is in Jerusalem.
This took place on Saturday, just inside the Gaza Strip, after a convoy, a UN aid convoy, of 109 trucks crossed from Israel into the Gaza Strip. And this is really badly needed aid, flour, medical supplies, food, water, if not water, but certainly vital supplies. And it got ambushed, basically, by an organized criminal network. These masked men who reportedly threw grenades, and they have taken off 97. They've taken away 97 out of the 109 trucks together with their contents. So, and at least two drivers were injured in the attack. There was a public outcry in Gaza about this because the territory desperately needs this aid. The problem is, of course, that who was providing security in Gaza before October the 7th, this murderous raid last year? Well, Hamas. And Hamas are fighting Israel, which has vowed to destroy them and to defeat them militarily. So, you know, there's inevitably a bit of a breakdown in law and order. Nevertheless, the surviving members of Hamas got together with some of the local tribes, who members of whom are thought to be involved in these criminal raids, and are mounting sort of raids of their own. And today there was a bit of a shootout, which has left reportedly up to 20 people dead and several people injured, as they try and take on these organized criminal networks who have incidentally been, as well as looting this stuff, they're storing it in their own warehouses and then selling it to middlemen and to citizens for extortionate prices, which most people can't afford.
Frank, just briefly, has the UN said what it can do to protect future aid supply?
Well, what they have said is that there is no plan B. There's no alternative to UNRWA, the UN Refugee and Works Agency, which has operated there for a long time. Israel wants UNRWA to, as already said, it's going to stop cooperating with it, because it suspects it of being complicit. Well, in fact, some of its members were complicit in the October the 7th raids. They've since been fired or killed. But nevertheless, Israel doesn't trust UNRWA. And UNRWA is saying, well, I'm sorry, that is the only way. It's the framework to 2.5 million people who are kettled into that area.
That was the BBC's security correspondent, Frank Gardner, speaking to me from Jerusalem. Stay with us on NewsHour. I'm Celia Hatton with NewsHour, coming to you live from our studio in London. Well, let's return to our top story. The Kremlin has warned that Washington's decision to allow Ukraine to fire U.S. missiles deep into Russia will create a new spiral of tension. The State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller would not confirm any policy changes in relation to the use of American long-distance missiles, but he said that it's Russia that has repeatedly escalated the conflict.
And that includes just in the recent month, when Russia recruited the deployment of more than 11,000 North Korean soldiers who are now on the front lines in Kursk, engaging in combat operations against the Ukrainian military. That is a major escalation by Russia, bringing in an Asian military to a conflict inside Europe. And the supporters of Ukraine's response to that needed to be firm. And we will continue to do what is appropriate to hold Russia accountable for its actions, including its escalatory actions, and to hold North Korea accountable for its escalatory actions.
So, no clear answer from the Biden administration, though it's been widely accepted that permission has been granted to Kyiv to use ATACMS missiles on Russian targets. Germany is not following suit. Kyiv has also been asking for German Taurus missiles that can travel up to 500 kilometers and penetrate layers of concrete. Berlin today reaffirmed its position of not sending these missiles to Ukraine. Earlier, I spoke to Neil Schmidt, a German MP and spokesperson on foreign affairs for the Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democratic Party. I asked him, what's Germany's reaction to the U.S. decision?
Germany will, of course, support this decision, but that does not mean that Germany automatically will deliver Taurus missiles to Ukraine. Very early on, the Chancellor made this judgment and came to the conclusion that this precise type of high-precision, very long-range missile should not be sent to Ukraine, and he will not change his mind.
This decision by Chancellor Scholz has come under criticism. We've heard the Polish president, Andrzej Duda, say it was a pity that Germany did not join France and the UK in aligning with the US on this issue. We've also heard the EU's chief diplomat, Josep Borrell, saying that he hoped other EU member states would follow this US decision. Does this show a split within the EU? Is the EU really failing to show a united front when it comes to dealing with Russia?
No, not at all. We've seen different instances of European governments not sending weapons to Ukraine, although they would be able to do so. So the French government didn't send any tanks to Ukraine. Other European governments did decide not to send fighter planes to Ukraine. Some European governments do not send much at all to Ukraine. And I think Germany has been one of the largest providers of ammunition and weaponry to Ukraine. And there will be another air defense system delivered before Christmas. So I think, except for Taurus, Germany has done a lot.
How much of this has to do with domestic German politics? The fact that Germany is hurtling towards its next election and the decision by Olaf Scholz to depict himself as the safer choice, to try to show a difference between his platform and that of his main contender. Does this really come down to trying to seem different?
No, that has nothing to do with electoral politics, because he made this choice very early on when he set up parameters for sending weapons to Ukraine in spring 2022. And from the very beginning, he was attached to the idea that you have to reassess the situation at every point in time, which allowed him to be more open to weapons deliveries later on. But in the case of Taurus, more than 1 year ago, he decided that he is not ready to send it to Ukraine. And he sticks to this decision even under pressure or even before election.
But how do you marry those two ideas? The idea that you're constantly reassessing the situation in Ukraine and how you can assist Ukraine. But at the same time, a decision has been made regarding these particular weapons and there's no willingness to re-examine that decision.
It's because of the use that can be made of this high-tech weaponry. So it is probably one of the most sophisticated long-range missiles that are deployed in NATO. It can reach Moscow. It would also need a long time of preparation to avoid German soldiers' involvement, which is a red line for the Chancellor, that German soldiers are taking part in the war effort. So for these reasons, he was very clear from the beginning that in the case of Taurus, it would not work, whereas he was more open for a re-examination of the situation when it came to other kind of weaponry, and we are still delivering lots of weapons. I think we should not concentrate only on Taurus, but on the larger picture, which is quite positive in terms of German contribution.
The Chancellor has gone out on a limb in terms of his willingness to reach out to Vladimir Putin. The two had a phone call on Friday and spoke for about an hour. How has the Chancellor's thinking or the government's thinking moved on since that phone call? Has the Chancellor arrived at a better plan for peace?
Well, I think there is no definite plan for peace among allies. There's just the idea that in the end, you will need also diplomacy to bring an end to the war. But before diplomacy can work, you need to increase military pressure on Russia, because otherwise Putin will not be willing to start negotiations at all. So first we need to overcome his conviction that he will prevail militarily. But at the same time, it's good that not only Mr. Trump speaks to Putin, but that European leaders do so too, because we can expect Mr. Trump, after taking office, becoming president again, will initiate some kind of conversation with Putin on Ukraine. And so it's better to have a European track of conversation with Putin as well.
Germany's governing Social Democratic Party's spokesperson on foreign affairs, Neil Schmid. Like all trades, the people smuggling networks set up to help migrants move around the globe depend on demand and supply. Demand is strong, not just because of war and climate change, but also because countries like Turkey no longer want to act as home to those they call their guests, millions of refugees. The number of people crossing to Europe through this route from Turkey into either Greece or Bulgaria has steadily risen in the past few years. And once migrants make it into the EU, many travel deeper into Europe. The BBC's Nick Robinson reports from the border between Turkey and Bulgaria, between the EU and the wider world.
So here we are.
This is the fence. You were searching for it very far away, but actually it was just very close.
My guide to the border is Hamid, a man who escaped from Iran to Turkey and then found himself thrown out of that country and decided to cross this border to make his way to safety in Bulgaria. He works now with an NGO that helps others like him who've made that journey.
I feel like we're at the top of the world now. We can see all the way around us.
Yeah.
Rolling hills, this tiny, really almost disused village here, isn't it? The odd farm, houses that have collapsed. So, this is Bulgaria?
Yeah. At the south, we can see the Turkey, and at east, it will be Greece.
So this is also the border of the EU?
Yes, the first border of EU. As you see, the fence is almost like 4 meters, but the wire is not visible from here, but because I know I crossed it, I saw it from close distance, you can see that there is wires on it, that the diameter is 1 meter, so half meter outside from left, half meter outside from right.
Yeah, so it's not just going up in the air, it's sticking out as well.
Also at the top, it's even become more. So they are very sharp and almost it's impossible to climb them with bare hands.
So what, you have to use ladders?
Usually they're using ladders. But there is some places that they already cut it. And sometimes there is pipe under it to gather the water. And yes, there is some bar on it, but they cut also the bars.
So when you came across this border, you didn't cross this fence. What did you do instead?
So after I left the town in Turkey and walking for almost half a day, I reached to the river. And this river was very wide and I have to swim on it. I was preparing myself, so I had big plastic bags to put my stuff on it, and I was swimming like more than a minute to cross this river.
So everything you own, you're either wearing or it's in a plastic bag.
Yeah.
On the river.
On the river, yeah. Everything was there.
This village is called Shtit, which means shield, a shield on the border. It's a place of dirt roads, of rundown farms, of falling down houses, dogs barking. Only the old are left here now. But one farmer in his 70s says he's seen the people cross the border. He's met the people, desperate people, coming with their children.
He has seen a whole family of Syrian refugees, a whole family with children. They walked around here.
They were just over here. Just
yes.
Here.
Yes, they were just over there. And he saw them. He called the police, and the police came and picked them up.
With little children?
Three small children on the
shoulders. On the shoulders.
And he felt very sad for them.
Yeah. And does this happen often?
Yeah, it happens from time to time.
Now this I did not expect. In this tiny, rather rundown village is a rather wonderful restaurant with a warm welcome and a chef called Nikolai. Nikolai, we're right on the border here.
Yeah.
The border with Turkey.
Yes.
Do you see many migrants try to cross the border?
I feel very safety on this place.
You're safe?
Because here many more policemen.
In the past, there were a lot of migrants that came in.
Before 2 years, many more Fujis, but now it's not.
Now not?
Now not.
Because the police?
Yes, and correct, protect area.
They protect the area, they have cameras?
Cameras, Frontex, policemen of Germany, of Poland, and different Europe countries.
What, you might wonder, has all this got to do with the arguments
about stopping the boats or smashing the gangs that bring people across the channel to Britain? The answer, quite simply, is everything. When countries like Turkey turn their back on refugees and want them to leave, they head to Europe.
Nick Robinson, reporting from the border between Bulgaria and Turkey, part of his ongoing series tracking the globe's new migration routes. Stay with us on NewsHour. This is NewsHour, coming to you on the BBC World Service. A new documentary has emerged from China that is already generating an Oscar buzz. It recounts an extraordinary incident from World War II when Chinese fishermen worked together to save hundreds of British prisoners of war from drowning. The story began when, in 1942, a Japanese ship moving around 1,800 British troops from Hong Kong to Japan as forced labor was hit by a torpedo and sank. Vincent Dowd tells us more.
When Japan invaded Britain's colony of Hong Kong at the end of 1941, newsreels at home tried to sound positive.
On the outbreak of hostilities, this easternmost outpost of the British Empire instantly rejected the Japanese ultimatum to surrender and girded itself to fight the invaders. Beleaguered Hong Kong straightway suffered the full fury of powerful land, sea and air forces and hit back.
But Japan's much bigger land, sea and air forces were victorious. After a year in captivity, 1,800 UK troops were sent in hideous conditions on the freighter the Lisbon Maru to become Japanese slave labour. The ship was torpedoed by a US submarine whose commander was unaware who was on board. Brian Finch is advisor to the new Chinese documentary, The Sinking of the Lisbon Maru.
It took some 24 hours for the ship to sink. During this period, the Japanese sent a rescue fleet, which lifted off all the Japanese troops who were on board and most of the crew of the ship, leaving the prisoners below deck. They also battened down the hatches to make sure the prisoners couldn't get out.
The Japanese were sentencing them to death, really.
More or less.
At the last moment, many of the POWs were able to escape and jump into the water. The film tracked down the final two survivors at the end of their lives, Dennis Morley and William Benningfield. In the film, their testimony is used with animated reconstructions.
Once you see Mum dead body, I mean, you become hardened to it. And I thought, my God, after what I've been through, is this the way I'm going to die? Target practice.
So I said, the heck with you guys, I'll go the other way.
But what makes this story different is that a couple of miles away on a Chinese island, fishing families had become aware of the unfolding disaster at sea.
Once the fishermen had discovered what was going on, the village elders organised a full rescue mission, and every man on the island who had a boat took it out and went again and again and again to rescue as many as they could. And they rescued a total of 384.
William Benningfield and Dennis Morley were among those astounded to find themselves pulled out of the water to safety.
And suddenly this light came on me.
I was swimming towards the island and I could see the rocks. And I thought to myself, how the hell am I going to get on those rocks? And the next thing I know, there's a little boat there.
I'll never forget this voice. This Chinese voice said, hello, I save you. And it was a Chinese fisherman from the islands I was trying to make to.
All I know is he was kind.
And he gave me some raw fish to eat and water to drink.
The next day, the survivors were rounded up again by the Japanese, except for three men who escaped back to England. Fang Li is known in China as a producer of feature films. He encountered this real-life story and decided to memorialise those who died, about 800 men, as well as the courage and humanity of the Chinese fishermen.
If you go to that island, people have a very strong
tradition of hospitality. Whoever in the water, no matter it's an enemy or friend, they will pick up. Many families have their loved ones lost at sea.
Producer Feng Li ending that report from Vincent Dowd. The French singer and composer Charles Dumont has died at the age of 95. He's best known as the composer of Non, je ne regrette rien, a song made famous by Edith Piaf.
Non, rien de rien.
Charles came to music through jazz, originally playing the trumpet. He became a songwriter, enjoying modest success until a chance meeting with Piaf, creating probably her most famous song. In 2018, Charles Dumont spoke to BBC Radio 2's Carte Blanche program, hosted by the French singer Vincent Niclot, and told the story.
By 1960, I was broke and really desperate. And one day I sat in front of this piano and I started to compose music. At this time, I didn't write the lyrics, so I called a friend of mine, Michel Vauquer, who was a lyricist. Michel came over and I played him the melody. Without saying anything, he went back home, and 3 days later, Michel called me and said, I've got the lyrics.
Il me dit, ça s'appelle Non, je ne regrette rien. J'ai dit, j'aime pas du tout.
The song is called Non, je ne regrette rien. And I didn't like the title at all. But Michel said, you know, we have to present this song to Edith Piaf. And I said, that's impossible. I met her 3 times already and it was a disaster. But I respected Michel as a wonderful lyricist and he said, it's too late. I already made an appointment with Edith.
Elle l'a chanté et de ce jour-là, ça a été une seconde naissance.
When she listened to the song, she was stunned. She started to sing it, and from that day, my whole life changed. I had a life before that moment, but from that day, it was like a rebirth. She gave me new lease on life. After she heard the song for the first time, she never looked at me the same way again. It was like she was looking at someone special. From that day, I wrote 30 songs for her, and she recorded 23 of the songs that I composed for her in the next 2 years, until the last one, which she recorded 2 months before she died.
That was Feng Li, producer of the documentary The Sinking of the Lisbon Maru, ending that report from the BBC's Vincent Dowd. Well, that's all we have for this edition of NewsHour. From me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team, thank you for listening.